This is disc number 10.
Of all the people I met, only one said anything of interest. This was Paul Schiff, whose father had made the arrangements for Fanshawe's job on the oil tanker. Schiff was now a pediatrician in Westchester County, and we spoke in his office one evening until quite late. There was an earnestness about him that I liked. A small, intense man, his hair already thinning, with steady eyes and a soft, resonant voice, and he talked openly, without any prodding. Fanshawe had been an important person in his life, and he remembered their friendship well. "I was a diligent boy," Schiff said, "hardworking, obedient, without much imagination. Fanshawe wasn't intimidated by Harvard the way the rest of us were, and I think I was in awe of that. He had read more than anyone else, more poets, more philosophers, more novelists, but the business of school seemed to bore him. He didn't care about grades, cut class a lot, just seemed to go his own way. In freshman year, we lived down the hall from each other, and for some reason he picked me out to be his friend. After that, I sort of tagged along after him. Fanshawe had so many ideas about everything. I think I learned more from him than from any of my classes. It was a bad case of hero worship, I suppose, but Fanshawe helped me, and I haven't forgotten it. He was the one who taught me to think for myself, to make my own choices. If it hadn't been for him, I never would have become a doctor. I switched to pre-med because he convinced me to do what I wanted to do, and I'm still grateful to him for it. Midway through our second year, Fanshawe told me that he was going to quit school. It didn't really surprise me. Cambridge wasn't the right place for Fanshawe, and I knew that he was restless, itching to get away. I talked to my father, who represented the Seamen's Union, and he worked out that job for Fanshawe on the ship. It was arranged very neatly. Fanshawe was whisked through all the paperwork, and a few weeks later he was off. I heard from him several times, postcards from here and there, "Hi, how are you?" that kind of thing. It didn't bother me, though, and I was glad that I'd been able to do something for him. But then all those good feelings eventually blew up in my face. I was in the city one day about 4 years ago, walking along Fifth Avenue, and I ran into Fanshawe right there on the street. I was delighted to see him, really surprised and happy, but he hardly even talked to me. It was as though he'd forgotten who I was, very stiff, almost rude. I had to force my address and phone number into his hand. He promised to call, but of course he never did. It hurt a lot, I can tell you. "The son of a bitch," I thought to myself. "Who does he think he is?" He wouldn't even tell me what he was doing, just evaded my questions and sauntered off. So much for college days, I thought. So much for friendship. It left an ugly taste in my mouth. Last year, my wife bought one of his books and gave it to me as a birthday present. I know it's childish, but I haven't had the heart to open it. It just sits there on the shelf collecting dust. It's very strange, isn't it? Everyone says it's a masterpiece, but I don't think I can ever bring myself to read it. This was the most lucid commentary I got from anyone. Some of the oil tanker shipmates had things to say, but nothing that really served my purpose. Otis Smart, for example, remembered the love letters Fanshawe had written for him. When I reached him by telephone in Baton Rouge, he went on about them at great length, even quoting some of the phrases Fanshawe had made up. "My darling Twinkletoes, my pumpkin squash woman, my wallow dream wickedness," and so on, laughing as he spoke. "The damnedest thing was," he said, "that the whole time he was sending those letters to Sue Ann, she was fooling around with someone else. And the day he got home, she announced to him that she was getting married." "It's just as well," Smart added. "I ran into Sue Ann back home last year, and she's up to about 300 pounds now. She looks like a cartoon fat lady. strutting down the street in orange stretch pants with a mess of brats bawling around her. It made me laugh, it did, remembering the letters. That Fanshawe really cracked me up. He'd get going with some of those lines of his and I'd start rolling on the floor like a monkey. It's too bad about what happened. You hate to hear about a guy punching his ticket so young. Jeffrey Brown, now a chef in a Houston restaurant, had been the assistant cook on the ship. He remembered Fanshawe as the one white crew member who had been friendly to him. "It wasn't easy," Brown said. "The crew was mostly a bunch of rednecks, and they'd just as soon spit at me as say hello. But Fanshawe stuck by me, didn't care what anyone thought. When we got into Baytown and places like that, we'd go ashore together for drinks, for girls, whatever. I knew those towns better than Fanshawe did, and I told him that if he wanted to stick with me, we couldn't go into the regular sailors' bars. I knew what my ass would be worth in places like that, and I didn't want trouble." "No problem," Fanshawe said, "and off we'd go to the black sections, no problem at all. Most of the time, things were pretty calm on the ship. Nothing I couldn't handle. But then this rough customer came on for a few weeks, a guy named Cutbirth, if you can believe it, Roy Cutbirth. He was a stupid, honky oiler who finally got thrown off the ship when the chief engineer figured out he didn't know squat about engines. He cheated on his oiler's test to get the job. Just the man to have down there if you want to blow up the ship. This Cutbirth was dumb, mean and dumb. He had those tattoos on his knuckles, a letter on each finger, L-O-V-E on the right hand, H-A-T-E on the left. When you see that kind of crazy shit, you just want to keep away. This guy once bragged to Fanshawe about how he used to spend his Saturday nights back home in Alabama, sitting on a hill over the interstate and shooting at cars. A charming fella, no matter how you put it. And then there was this sick eye he had, all bloodshot and messed up. But he liked to brag about that, too. Seems he got it one day when a piece of glass flew into it. That was in Selma, he said, throwing bottles at Martin Luther King. I don't have to tell you that this Cutbirth wasn't my bosom buddy. He used to give me a lot of stares, muttering under his breath and nodding to himself, but I paid no attention. Things went on like that for a while. Then he tried it with Fanshawe around, and the way it came out, it was just a little too loud for Fanshawe to ignore. He stops, turns to Cutbirth, and says, "What did you say?" And Cutbirth, all tough and cocky, says something like, "I was just wondering when you and the Jungle Bunny are getting married, sweetheart." Well, Fanshawe was always peaceable and friendly, a real gentleman, if you know what I mean. And so I wasn't expecting what happened. It was like watching that Hulk on the TV, the man who turns into a beast. All of a sudden, he got angry, I mean raging, damn near beside himself with anger. He grabbed Cutbirth by the shirt and just threw him against the wall, just pinned him there and held on, breathing right into his face. "Don't ever say that again," Fanshawe says, his eyes all on fire. "Don't ever say that again or I'll kill you." And damned if you didn't believe him when he said it. The guy was ready to kill, and Cutbirth knew it. "Just joking," he says, "just making a little joke." And that was the end of it, real fast. The whole thing didn't take more than half a blink. About 2 days later, Cutbirth got fired. A lucky thing, too. If he'd stayed around any longer, there's no telling what might have happened. I got dozens of statements like this one, from letters, from phone conversations, from interviews. It went on for months, and each day the material expanded, grew in geometric surges, accumulating more and more associations, a chain of contacts that eventually took on a life of its own. It was an infinitely hungry organism. And in the end, I saw that there was nothing to prevent it from becoming as large as the world itself. A life touches one life, which in turn touches another life, and very quickly the links are innumerable, beyond calculation. I knew about a fat woman in a small Louisiana town, I knew about a demented racist with tattoos on his fingers and a name that defied understanding. I knew about dozens of people I had never heard of before, and each one had been a part of Fanshawe's life. All well and good, perhaps, and one might say that this surplus of knowledge was the very thing that proved I was getting somewhere. I was a detective, after all, and my job was to hunt for clues. Faced with a million bits of random information, led down a million paths of false inquiry, I had to find the one path that would take me where I wanted to go. So far, the essential fact was that I hadn't found it. None of these people had seen or heard from Fanshawe in years, and short of doubting everything they told me, short of beginning an investigation into each one of them, I had to assume they were telling the truth. What it boiled down to, I think, was a question of method. In some sense, I already knew everything there was to know about Fanshawe. The things I learned did not teach me anything important, did not go against any of the things I already knew. Or, to put it another way, the Fanshawe I had known was not the same Fanshawe I was looking for. There had been a break somewhere, a sudden, incomprehensible break, and the things I was told by the various people I questioned did not account for it. In the end, their statements only confirmed that what had happened could not possibly have happened. That Fanshawe was kind, that Fanshawe was cruel, this was an old story, and I already knew it by heart. What I was looking for was something different, something I could not even imagine, a purely irrational act, a thing totally out of character, a contradiction of everything Fanshawe had been up to the moment he vanished. I kept trying to leap into the unknown, but each time I landed, I found myself on home ground, surrounded by what was most familiar to me. The farther I went, the more the possibilities narrowed. Perhaps that was a good thing, I don't know. If nothing else, I knew that each time I failed, there would be one less place to look. Months went by, more months than I would like to admit. In February and March, I spent most of my time looking for Quinn, the private detective who had worked for Sophie. Strangely enough, I couldn't find a trace of him. It seemed that he was no longer in business, not in New York, not anywhere. For a while, I investigated reports of unclaimed bodies, questioned people who worked at the city morgue, tried to track down his family, but nothing came of it. As a last resort, I considered hiring another private detective to look for him, but then decided not to. One missing man was enough, I felt, and then little by little I used up the possibilities that were left. By mid-April, I was down to the last one. I held out for a few more days, hoping I would get lucky, but nothing developed. On the morning of the 21st, I finally walked into a travel agency and booked a flight to Paris. I was supposed to leave on a Friday. On Tuesday, Sophie and I went shopping for a record player. One of her younger sisters was about to move to New York, and we were planning to give her our old record player as a present. The idea of replacing it had been in the air for several months, and this finally gave us an excuse to go looking for a new one. So we went downtown that Tuesday, bought the thing, and then lugged it home in a cab. We hooked it up in the same spot where the old one had been, and then packed away the old one in the new box. A clever solution, we thought. Karen was due to arrive in May, and in the meantime we wanted to keep it somewhere out of sight. That was when we ran into a problem. Storage space was limited, as it is in most New York apartments, and it seemed that we didn't have any left. The one closet that offered any hope was in the bedroom, but the floor was already crammed with boxes, three deep, two high, four across, and there wasn't enough room on the shelf above. These were the cartons that held Fanshawe's things, clothes, books, odds and ends, and they had been there since the day we moved in. Neither Sophie nor I had known what to do with them when she cleaned out her old place. We didn't want to be surrounded by memories of Fanshawe and our new life, but at the same time it seemed wrong just to throw the things away. The boxes had been a compromise, and eventually we no longer seemed to notice them. They became a part of the domestic landscape, like the broken floorboard under the living room rug, like the crack in the wall above our bed, invisible in the flux of daily life. Now, as Sophie opened the door of the closet and looked inside, her mood suddenly changed. "Enough of this," she said, squatting down in the closet. She pushed away the clothes that were draped over the boxes, clicking hangers against each other, parting the jumble in frustration. It was an abrupt anger, and it seemed to be directed more at herself than at me. "Enough of what?" I was standing on the other side of the bed, watching her back. "All of it," she said, still flinging the clothes back and forth. "Enough of Fanshawe and his boxes." "What do you want to do with them?" I sat down on the bed and waited for an answer, but she didn't say anything. "What do you want to do with them, Sophie?" I asked again. She turned around and faced me, and I could see that she was on the point of tears. "What good is a closet if you can't even use it?" she said. Her voice was trembling, losing control. "I mean, he's dead, isn't he? And if he's dead, why do we need all this, gesturing, groping for the word, garbage? It's like living with a corpse." "If you want, we can call the Salvation Army today," I said.
"Call them now, before we say another word."
"I will, but first we'll have to open the boxes and sort through them."
"No, I want it to be everything all at once."
"It's fine for the clothes," I said, "but I wanted to hold on to the books for a while. I've been meaning to make a list, and I wanted to check for any notes in the margins. I could finish in half an hour." Sophie looked at me in disbelief.
"You don't understand anything, do you?" she said.
And then as she stood up, the tears finally came out of her eyes. Child's tears, tears that held nothing back, falling down her cheeks as if she didn't know they were there.
"I can't get through to you anymore. You just don't hear what I'm saying."
"I'm doing my best, Sophie."
"No, you're not. You think you are, but you're not. Don't you see what's happening? You're bringing him back to life."
"I'm writing a book, that's all, just a book. But if I don't take it seriously, how can I hope to get it done?"
"There's more to it than that. I know it. I can feel it. If the two of us are going to last, he's got to be dead. Don't you understand that? Even if he's alive, he's got to be dead."
"What are you talking about? Of course he's dead."
"Not for much longer. Not if you keep it up."
"But you were the one who got me started. You wanted me to do the book."
"That was 100 years ago, my darling. I'm so afraid I'm going to lose you. I couldn't take it if that happened."
"It's almost finished, I promise. This trip is the last step.
And then what?"
"We'll see. I can't know what I'm getting into until I'm in it."
"That's what I'm afraid of."
"You could go with me. To Paris?" "To Paris. The three of us could go together."
"I don't think so. Not the way things are now. You go alone. At least then, if you come back, it will be because you want to."
"What do you mean, if?"
"Just that. If. As in, if you come back."
"You can't believe that."
"But I do. If things go on like this, I'm going to lose you."
"Don't talk like that, Sophie."
"I can't help it. You're so close to being gone already. I sometimes think I can see you vanishing before my eyes."
"That's nonsense."
"You're wrong. We're coming to the end, my darling, and you don't even know it. You're going to vanish, and I'll never see you again."
Chapter 8.
Things felt oddly bigger to me in Paris. The sky was more present than in New York, its whims more fragile. I found myself drawn to it, and for the first day or two I watched it constantly, sitting in my hotel room and studying the clouds, waiting for something to happen. These were northern clouds, the dream clouds that are always changing, massing up into huge gray mountains, discharging brief showers, dissipating, gathering again, rolling across the sun, refracting the light in ways that always seemed different. The Paris sky has its own laws, and they function independently of the city below. If the buildings appear solid, anchored in the earth, indestructible, the sky is vast and amorphous, subject to constant turmoil. For the first week, I felt as though I had been turned upside down. This was an old-world city, and it had nothing to do with New York, with its slow skies and chaotic streets, its bland clouds and aggressive buildings. I had been displaced, and it made me suddenly unsure of myself. I felt my grip loosening, and at least once an hour I had to remind myself why I was there. My French was neither good nor bad. I had enough to understand what people said to me, but speaking was difficult, and there were times when no words came to my lips, when I struggled to say even the simplest things. There was a certain pleasure in this, I believe, to experience language as a collection of sounds, to be forced to the surface of words where meanings vanish. But it was also quite wearing, and it had the effect of shutting me up in my thoughts. In order to understand what people were saying, I had to translate everything silently into English, which meant that even when I understood, I was understanding at one remove, doing twice the work and getting half the result. Nuances, subliminal associations, undercurrents, all these things were lost on me. In the end, it would probably not be wrong to say that everything was lost on me. Still, I pushed ahead. It took me a few days to get the investigation started, but once I made my first contact, others followed. There were a number of disappointments, however. Vishnogradsky was dead. I was unable to locate any of the people Fanshawe had tutored in English. The woman who had hired Fanshawe at the New York Times was gone, had not worked there in years. Such things were to be expected, but I took them hard, knowing that even the smallest gap could be fatal. These were empty spaces for me, blanks in the picture. And no matter how successful I was in filling the other areas, doubts would remain, which meant that the work could never be truly finished. I spoke to the Deadmans. I spoke to the art book publishers Fanshawe had worked for. I spoke to the woman named Anne, a girlfriend, it turned out. I spoke to the movie producer.
"Odd jobs," he said to me in Russian-accented English. "That's what he did. Translations, script summaries, a little ghostwriting for my wife. He was a smart boy, but too stiff. Very literary, if you know what I'm saying. I wanted to give him a chance to act, even offered to give him fencing and riding lessons for a picture we were going to do. I liked his looks, thought we could make something of him. But he wasn't interested. I've got other eggs to fry," he said, something like that. "It didn't matter. The picture made millions, and what do I care if the boy wants to act or not?"
There was something to be pursued here. But as I sat with this man in his monumental apartment on the Avenue Henri Martin, waiting for each sentence of his story between phone calls, I suddenly realized that I didn't need to hear any more. There was only one question that mattered, and this man couldn't answer it for me. If I stayed and listened to him, I would be given more details, more irrelevancies, yet another pile of useless notes. I had been pretending to write a book for too long now, and little by little I had forgotten my purpose. "Enough," I said to myself, consciously echoing Sophie, "enough of this." And then I stood up and left. The point was that no one was watching me anymore. I no longer had to put up a front as I had at home, no longer had to delude Sophie by creating endless busywork for myself. The charade was over. I could discard my non-existent book at last. For about 10 minutes, walking back to my hotel across the river, I felt happier than I had in months. Things had been simplified, reduced to the clarity of a single problem. But then the moment I absorbed this thought, I understood how bad the situation really was. I was coming to the end now and still hadn't found him. The mistake I was looking for had never surfaced. There were no leads, no clues, no tracks to follow. Fanshawe was buried somewhere, and his whole life was buried with him. Unless he wanted to be found, I didn't have a ghost of a chance. Still, I pushed ahead, trying to come to the end, to the very end, burrowing blindly through the last interviews, not willing to give up until I had seen everyone. I wanted to call Sophie. One day, I even went so far as to walk to the post office and wait in line for the foreign operator, but I didn't go through with it. Words were failing me constantly now, and I panicked at the thought of losing my nerve on the phone. What was I supposed to say, after all? Instead, I sent her a postcard with a photograph of Laurel and Hardy on it. On the back, I wrote, "True marriages never make sense. Look at the couple on the other side. Proof that anything is possible, no? Perhaps we should start wearing derbies. At the very least, remember to clean out the closet before I return. Hugs to Ben." I saw Anne Michaud the following afternoon, and she gave a little start when I entered the café where we had arranged to meet, Le Roquet, Boulevard Saint-Germain. What she told me about Fanshawe is not important. Who kissed who, what happened where, who said what, and so on. It comes down to more of the same. What I will mention, however, is that her initial double take was caused by the fact that she mistook me for Fanshawe. Just the briefest flicker, as she put it, but then it was gone. The resemblance had been noticed before, of course, but never so viscerally, with such immediate impact. I must have shown my reaction, for she quickly apologized, as if she had done something wrong, and returned to the point several times during the 2 or 3 hours we spent together, once even going out of her way to contradict herself.
"I don't know what I was thinking. You don't look at all like him. It must have been the American in both of you."
Nevertheless, I found it disturbing, could not help feeling appalled. Something monstrous was happening, and I had no control over it anymore. The sky was growing dark inside, that much was certain. The ground was trembling. I found it hard to sit still, and I found it hard to move. From one moment to the next, I seemed to be in a different place, to forget where I was. "Thoughts stop where the world begins," I kept telling myself. "But the self is also in the world," I answered, "and likewise the thoughts that come from it." The problem was that I could no longer make the right distinctions. This can never be that. Apples are not oranges, peaches are not plums. You feel the difference on your tongue, and then you know, as if inside yourself. But everything was beginning to have the same taste to me. I no longer felt hungry. I could no longer bring myself to eat. As for the Deadmans, there is perhaps even less to say. Fanshawe could not have chosen more fitting benefactors, and of all the people I saw in Paris, they were the kindest, the most gracious. Invited to their apartment for drinks, I stayed on for dinner, and then, by the time we reached the second course, they were urging me to visit their house in the Var, the same house where Fanshawe had lived. And it needn't be a short visit, they said, since they were not planning to go there themselves until August. It had been an important place for Fanshawe and his work, Mr. Deadman said, and no doubt my book would be enhanced if I saw it myself. I couldn't disagree with him. And no sooner were these words out of my mouth than Mrs. Deadman was on the phone, making arrangements for me in her precise and elegant French. There was nothing to hold me in Paris anymore, and so I took the train the following afternoon. This was the end of the line for me. my southward trek to oblivion. Whatever hope I might have had, the faint possibility that Fanshawe had returned to France, the illogical thought that he had found refuge in the same place twice, evaporated by the time I got there. The house was empty. There was no sign of anyone. On the second day, examining the rooms on the upper floor, I came across a short poem Fanshawe had written on the wall. But I knew that poem already. And under it there was a date, August 25th, 1972. He had never come back. I felt foolish now even for thinking it. For want of anything better to do, I spent several days talking to people in the area, the nearby farmers, the villagers, the people of surrounding towns. I introduced myself by showing them a photograph of Fanshawe, pretending to be his brother, but feeling more like a down-and-out private eye, a buffoon clutching at straws. Some people remembered him, others didn't, still others weren't sure. It made no difference. I found the southern accent impenetrable, with its rolling R's and nasalized endings, and barely understood a word that was said to me. Of all the people I saw, only one had heard from Fanshawe since his departure. This was his closest neighbor, a tenant farmer, who lived about a mile down the road. He was a peculiar little man of about 40, dirtier than anyone I had ever met. His house was a dank, crumbling 17th-century structure, and he seemed to live there by himself, with no companions but his truffle dog and hunting rifle. He was clearly proud of having been Fanshawe's friend, and to prove how close they had been, he showed me a white cowboy hat that Fanshawe had sent to him after returning to America. There was no reason not to believe his story. The hat was still in its original box and apparently had never been worn. He explained that he was saving it for the right moment, and then launched into a political harangue that I had trouble following. The revolution was coming, he said, and when it did, he was going to buy a white horse and a machine gun, put on his hat, and ride down the main street in town, plugging all the shopkeepers who had collaborated with the Germans during the war. Just like in America, he added. When I asked him what he meant, he delivered a rambling, hallucinatory lecture about cowboys and Indians. But that was a long time ago, I said, trying to cut him short. No, no, he insisted. It still goes on today. Didn't I know about the shootouts on Fifth Avenue? Hadn't I heard of the Apaches? It was pointless to argue. In defense of my ignorance, I told him that I lived in another neighborhood. I stayed on in the house for a few more days. My plan was to do nothing for as long as I could to rest up. I was exhausted, and I needed a chance to regroup before going back to Paris. A day or two went by. I walked through the fields, visited the woods, sat out in the sun reading French translations of American detective novels. It should have been the perfect cure, holing up in the middle of nowhere, letting my mind float free. But none of it really helped. The house wouldn't make room for me, and by the third day I sensed that I was no longer alone, that I could never be alone in that place. Fanshawe was there, and no matter how hard I tried not to think about him, I couldn't escape. This was unexpected, galling. Now that I had stopped looking for him, he was more present to me than ever before. The whole process had been reversed. After all these months of trying to find him, I felt as though I was the one who had been found. Instead of looking for Fanshawe, I had actually been running away from him. The work I had contrived for myself, the false book, the endless detours, had been no more than an attempt to ward him off, a ruse to keep him as far away from me as possible. For if I could convince myself that I was looking for him, then it necessarily followed that he was somewhere else, somewhere beyond me, beyond the limits of my life. But I had been wrong. Fanshawe was exactly where I was, and he had been there since the beginning. From the moment his letter arrived, I had been struggling to imagine him, to see him as he might have been, but my mind had always conjured a blank. At best, there was one impoverished image, the door of a locked room. That was the extent of it. Fanshawe, alone in that room, condemned to a mythical solitude. Living, perhaps, breathing, perhaps, dreaming God knows what. This room, I now discovered, was located inside my skull. Strange things happened to me after that. I returned to Paris, but once there I found myself with nothing to do. I didn't want to look up any of the people I had seen before, and I didn't have the courage to go back to New York. I became inert, a thing that could not move, and little by little I lost track of myself. If I am able to say anything about this period at all, it is only because I have certain documentary evidence to help me. The visa stamps in my passport, for example, my airplane ticket, my hotel bill, and so on. These things prove to me that I remained in Paris for more than a month. But that is very different from remembering, and in spite of what I know, I still find it impossible. I see things that happened. I encounter images of myself in various places, but only at a distance, as though I were watching someone else. None of it feels like memory, which is always anchored within. It's out there, beyond what I can feel or touch, beyond anything that has to do with me. I have lost a month from my life, and even now it is a difficult thing for me to confess, a thing that fills me with shame. A month is a long time, more than enough time for a man to come apart. Those days come back to me in fragments, when they come at all, bits and pieces that refuse to add up. I see myself falling down drunk on the street one night, standing up, staggering towards a lamppost, and then vomiting all over my shoes. I see myself sitting in a movie theater with the lights on and watching a crowd of people file out around me, unable to remember the film I had just seen. I see myself prowling the Rue Saint-Denis at night, picking out prostitutes to sleep with, my head burning with the thought of bodies, an endless jumble of naked breasts, naked thighs, naked buttocks. I see my cock being sucked. I see myself on a bed with two girls kissing each other. I see an enormous black woman spreading her legs on a bidet and washing her cunt. I will not try to say that these things are not real, that they did not happen. It's just that I can't account for them. I was fucking the brains out of my head, drinking myself into another world. But if the point was to obliterate Fanshawe, then my binge was a success. He was gone, and I was gone along with him. The end, however, is clear to me. I have not forgotten it, and I feel lucky to have kept that much. The entire story comes down to what happened at the end, and without that end inside me now, I could not have started this book. The same holds for the two books that come before it, City of Glass and Ghosts. These three stories are finally the same story, but each one represents a different stage in my awareness of what it is about. I don't claim to have solved any problems. I am merely suggesting that a moment came when it no longer frightened me to look at what had happened. If words followed, it was only because I had no choice but to accept them, to take them upon myself and go where they wanted me to go. But that does not necessarily make the words important. I have been struggling to say goodbye to something for a long time now, and this struggle is all that really matters. The story is not in the words. It's in the struggle. One night, I found myself in a bar near the Place Pigalle. Found is the term I wish to use, for I have no idea of how I got there, no memory of entering the place at all. It was one of those clip joints that are common in the neighborhood. Six or eight girls at the bar, the chance to sit at a table with one of them and buy an exorbitantly priced bottle of champagne, and then, if one is so inclined, the possibility of coming to a certain financial arrangement and retiring to the privacy of a room in the hotel next door. The scene begins for me as I'm sitting at one of the tables with a girl, just having received the bucket of champagne. The girl was Tahitian, I remember, and she was beautiful. No more than 19 or 20, very small, and wearing a dress of white netting with nothing underneath. A crisscross of cables over her smooth brown skin. The effect was superbly erotic. I remember her round breasts visible in the diamond-shaped openings, the overwhelming softness of her neck when I leaned over and kissed it. She told me her name, but I insisted on calling her Feiwei, telling her that she was an exile from Taipei and that I was Herman Melville, an American sailor who had come all the way from New York to rescue her. She hadn't the vaguest idea of what I was talking about, but she continued to smile, no doubt thinking me crazy as I rambled on in my sputtering French, unperturbed, laughing when I laughed, allowing me to kiss her wherever I liked. We were sitting in an alcove in the corner, and from my seat I was able to take in the rest of the room. Men came and went, some popping their heads through the door and leaving, some staying for a drink at the bar, one or two going to a table as I had done. After about 15 minutes, a young man came in who was obviously American. He seemed nervous to me, as if he had never been in such a place before. But his French was surprisingly good, and as he fluently ordered a whiskey at the bar and started talking to one of the girls, I saw that he meant to stay for a while. I studied him from my little nook, continuing to run my hand along Feiwei's leg and to nuzzle her with my face. But the longer he stood there, the more distracted I became. He was tall, athletically built, with sandy hair and an open, somewhat boyish manner. I guessed his age at 26 or 27. A graduate student, perhaps, or else a young lawyer working for an American firm in Paris. I had never seen this man before, and yet there was something familiar about him, something that stopped me from turning away. A brief scald, a weird synapse of recognition. I tried out various names on him, shunted him through the past, unraveled the spool of associations, but nothing happened. He's no one, I said to myself, finally giving up. And then, out of the blue, by some muddled chain of reasoning, I finished the thought by adding, "And if he's no one, then he must be Fanshawe." I laughed out loud at my joke. Ever on the alert, Feiwei laughed with me. I knew that nothing could be more absurd, but I said it again, Fanshawe, and then again, Fanshawe, and the more I said it, the more it pleased me to say it. Each time the word came out of my mouth, another burst of laughter followed. I was intoxicated by the sound of it. It drove me to a pitch of raucousness, and little by little Feiwei seemed to grow confused. She had probably thought I was referring to some sexual practice, making some joke she couldn't understand, but my repetitions had gradually robbed the word of its meaning, and she began to hear it as a threat. I looked at the man across the room and spoke the word again. My happiness was immeasurable. I exulted in the sheer falsity of my assertion, celebrating the new power I had just bestowed upon myself. I was the sublime alchemist who could change the world at will. This man was Fanshawe because I said he was Fanshawe, and that was all there was to it. Nothing could stop me anymore. Without even pausing to think, I whispered into Feiwei's ear that I would be right back, disengaged myself from her wonderful arms, and sauntered over to the pseudo-Fanshawe at the bar. In my best imitation of an Oxford accent, I said,
"Well, old man, fancy that. We meet again."
He turned around and looked at me carefully. The smile that had been forming on his face slowly diminished into a frown. "Do I know you?" he finally asked.
"Of course you do," I said, all bluster and good humor. "The name's Melville, Herman Melville. Perhaps you've read some of my books."
He didn't know whether to treat me as a jovial drunk or a dangerous psychopath, and the confusion showed on his face. It was a splendid confusion, and I enjoyed it thoroughly. "Well," he said at last, forcing out a little smile, "I might have read one or two.
The one about the whale, no doubt."
Yes, the one about the whale. I'm glad to hear it, I said, nodding pleasantly, and then put my arm around his shoulder. And so, Fanshawe, I said, what brings you to Paris this time of year?
This is the end of disc number 10. Please insert disc number 11.